We're beginning our study, or continuing our study, with the beginning of Hebrews. And we come here this morning to the second half of the author of Hebrews' first point. Last week, we saw how in these last days, Jesus is the culmination of the plan of God to bring about the kingdom of the world to come. Now, if we drift away from such a great salvation, how will we escape the coming retribution? That's the question that's presented to us. Now, the second half of that first point expresses a problem, and the problem we'll see is in verse 8 of today's passage. We do not yet see everything in subjection to Him. That is, that we live in a world in which there is, in verse 9, the suffering of death. That we are engaged in a battle, verse 14, with the one who has the power of death. And though we've been brought out of darkness and a lifelong slavery, we are a people who have not fully entered into the promise that has been accomplished, this abiding place of living in that world to come. In fact, we're very much like the Israelites. And this is kind of the big metaphor, the big picture for the letter to the Hebrews, for us to kind of get our imagination around, is with respect to how he is talking to his congregation, how he is encouraging and exhorting them. We're very much like the Israelites who have, after having been delivered from under Pharaoh's hand in Egypt, have yet to take possession of the promised land. They're in this in-between place. And what the author of Hebrews wants us to know today is that you will never make it through the temptations of this wilderness struggle unless you, one, face reality, and two, see Him. And you see Him as your king, your champion, your brother, and your priest. I'd like Diane Zabrowski to come forward and to read our passage.
Our sermon texts this morning are from Hebrews 2, 5 through 18. For it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside his control. At present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. But we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children God has given me. Since, therefore, the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. For surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. This is the word of the Lord.
So firstly, you are not going to make it through the desert trial of temptation if you first don't face reality. Right? In order to understand the author's line of reasoning, I want you to see the but in verse 9 as a big turn. It's a turn of thought like what happens in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, where Paul writes, "We were by nature children of wrath like the rest of mankind, but God." It's that kind of a transition. Here, this transition is in verse 8 and 9, and it reads, "We do not yet see everything in subjection to him, but we see him." The hymns which come before are a reference to Adam, the first man. And the hymns which follow verse 9 refer to him who for a little while was made a little lower than the angels, namely Jesus. This transition, it directs us from the present in which we do not yet see to the world to come of which we are speaking, the author of Hebrews says. So firstly, let's look at this present in which we do not yet see. The Lord did not create Adam to be the servant of angels or a slave to the world. The first man was a king. He was made after the angels and placed in the garden of the Lord's creation. The Lord afforded him a great honor. He was crowned with glory and honor, and everything was placed in subjection to him. The garden was his to guard. He was given dominion over it. The garden of creation was his to tend and to nurture. The first man and woman were to fill and to subdue the earth, that is, to extend the boundaries of the garden to the ends of the earth, not in acts of violence or domination or self-will, right, or against its will, but in such a way as to cultivate in it its vitality. He named the animals, which naming is a dominical act. It's the act of a king. He named the animals, and through this work of sub-creating, he became a mirror in God's creation of God's own beauty and majesty and glory, right? It was all given to the first man and woman except for one thing. Rather than trust the Lord and obey his command, the man and the woman turned away from the Lord and they took for themselves. They became poachers. They figuratively and literally took matters into their own hands. They would be the deciders of what was good and evil. And Adam, our king, our founder, our brother, our garden priest, pulled down ruin and death upon the heads of us all. Now, this reality, right, is not a reality that I need to, I think, convince you to believe. All of us know this world is a frustrating, broken place. Right? No one believes that justice is always happening in this world. No one, I think, believes that they themselves are perfect. Right? We know that the world is broken. Now, everything since the fall, because of that reality, every story that has been told is actually an attempt to try and explain, right, the qualities or the conditions of the reality in which we do not yet see. Right? How on earth, all of our stories are asking, did we get here? Right? Humanity sought to explain and give an answer to its experience of alienation in story. And when you're personally confronted with a world that is not right, you tell yourself a story. Right? Just from the mundane acts of the day, right? Somebody doesn't look at you right, and you say, they must not like me. Or something doesn't go right at work, and you say, things never go my way. The power of stories, it fills our understanding of where we imagine we are and what things mean and whether there's any hope of things ever getting any better. Right? One of the most easiest and contemporary ways we answer these questions surrounding this experience of our alienation is with cynicism and skepticism. It's the age of Seinfeld, actually, right? It's the imagination of Seinfeld. It seems a reasonable response, right? I must continually confront the brokenness and disappointments of the world, right? And cynicism and skepticism seems to do so without any cost, right? Things are just broken. But cynicism and skepticism do come at a cost, right? That way of looking at the world can easily become a malady of the soul and the heart. It can become a sin which monastics in the 4th century, 3rd century, called acedia, which today we know as sloth. Sloth isn't just laziness. It's a spiritual condition. Sloth is doing nothing because nothing is worth doing. What's sinful about acedia is that it's a loveless state of being. It lives for nothing because there is nothing worth dying for. You hear that? It lives for nothing because there is nothing worth dying for. Right? This darkness, the futility which fills a cynical and a skeptical mindset, it's really unlivable. You can't live in this world that way. Right? That kind of character quality is called saturnine, which I love that word. The saturnine outlook, it actually becomes itself a kind of a joke. And so we got to the end of maybe a work week, and everyone around the TV on a Saturday night around 7 p.m. all sang together, "Gloom, despair, and agony on me. Deep, dark, depressive, excessive misery. If it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. Gloom, despair, and agony on me." Right. Now, it's an unlivable way of living your life. It doesn't mean that there is not a place for grief and doubt and dejection. That's reality too. That's the world we live in. You have to account for the brokenness that's in the world. But though as Christians we give it a place in the room, we don't allow it to sit at the head of the table. Now, a more commonly agreed upon way to answer the question surrounding our alienation is to tell a story through a person. This kind of story constantly is bubbling up in our imagination, whether they are the stories through superheroes and all of those movies that have come out in the past decade or two decades. They come out in Disney princess movies, my particular favorite. But I don't recommend movies. But I know everybody on this island seems so happy on this island. Everything is by design. I know everyone on this island has a role on this island, so maybe I can roll with mine. Right? We tell ourselves that if we could only fully express our individuality, we would be able to live in a world fulfilled as an individual. The problem is that none of the stories that we tell ourselves tell that story. Right? Moana, who I was quoting earlier, isn't independent, and her fulfillment doesn't come through individualistic self-expressionism. She gets bullied by the water to go on a quest in which she almost is killed. And for what purpose? Right? She speaks of this role that she has to play. Every road, though, leads back to the place I know where I cannot go, where I long to be, right? It's almost as if she does not yet see everything, let alone what it is that she was made for. It's almost as if there has been a longing placed inside her heart to drive her to ask and to seek and to knock. It's almost as if something or someone is calling her. And her seeming longing to escape to the constraints of the island are really a call to something more that includes great trial and suffering. And for what? For her own sake? For her own self-actualization? No. For her community. Right? To give one's life in such a great quest is not meaningless. It affords purpose in the midst of great challenge. It ennobles an individual. It lifts them up. And to follow such a person who has confidence, who believes in the purpose and the hope and the quest, it gives confidence and meaning to all of those who come after. Yet in this world, we do not yet see. Disappointment is always near. Rather than hold out for the hope for one who could lead us to a place of fulfillment where everything is set right, we say, get real. In reality, every one of the heroes that we have imagined has been flawed, has shown themselves to be flawed. No one is that good, we think. So you know what we do? We create another kind of hero. One more like us, one more real, one who actually is flawed, and we call him or her an anti-hero. That's the new genre. Try as we like, right? We want to tell stories of ultimate goodness, but the way in which we read those stories is all white. Now, what I mean by that is that comes, and that's an expression that comes from a writer who said this: happiness reads in white ink on a white page. Happiness reads in white ink on a white page. What did he mean by that, do you think? Can you imagine what he meant? Right? You know, the goodness that is so good, somehow we become disconnected from. And as a consequence, we give up our utopian dreams for dystopian nightmares. Right? Our hero's character is marked not with a white hat or a black hat, but with a value of grayness. We have to face reality. Things are not as they should be, right? The problem I have with some of the most recent retellings of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit is that the evil is more grotesque than I ever imagined it, and the goodness is never as good as I hoped, right? Something more is calling to us. It's calling from beyond the horizon of the sky and sea, right? And just as we feel that longing right in here, it's out there. The question is there any hope of getting beyond the line where the sky meets the sea, right? Can we, will we ever cross it? And will what seems to be calling us from beyond, will it come and find us? Our preacher has an answer for us, right? Though at present we do not yet see everything, the preacher of Hebrews tells us. But we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor. Right? If we're to make it through the wilderness of the world in which we do not yet see, where death inhabits everything that we do see, and which is merely not just one kind of death, but there's a whole species of death, right? If we're to live in this world and face this world with faith and hope and love as we pass through it in the midst of sufferings and trials, we need a perfect king, champion, brother, and priest. That's the author of Hebrews' answer to our question. The author of Hebrews says, first we see Jesus crowned with glory and honor. Right? His glory doesn't come from jumping off the top turnbuckle onto the top of the heads of his enemies. Right? His glory is a consequence of his own suffering and death, in which he tastes death for everyone. Paul says it similarly in 1 Corinthians 15, for as in Adam, so in Christ shall all be made alive. Right? This king jumped from on high into the very depths of the grave so as to bear the full weight of Adam's covenant curse for us all. And in so doing, he is victorious over everything, over sin, over death, and over the one who, he says, has the power of death. We have a king. We have a champion. Verse 10, the ESV translates the Greek word archegos as founder. The preacher of Hebrews is going to refer to that again in Hebrews chapter 12 when he speaks of Jesus as the founder and perfecter of our faith. It's the same word that Peter uses in his sermon that he preaches in Jerusalem in Acts chapter 3 when he says, and you killed the author of life, whom God raised from the dead, to this we are witnesses. Right? That Jesus is a king, a champion, a founder, an author, right, is the power behind the image from which C.S. Lewis draws his portrayal of Aslan in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I'm going to use a lot of Lord of the Rings quotes this summer, so if you're not signed up for the Narnian Summer Book Club, you know, you just might as well be in, because I'm going to be talking a lot about it. But in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the first of these books, Aslan is a great lion king of the country of Narnia, the land of Narnia. And Aslan stands in for Edmund, who is a young child and a traitor, who's turned greedily on his brother and sisters, who has aligned himself with the White Witch, who is the enemy of Narnia. And the White Witch is the embodiment of pride, right? She's the embodiment of being chronically cynical and skeptical, right? She is the one who, if I might say, is individualistically self-expressionistic. She wants to be the boss, her word to be the word, right? Both in denying the majesty of Aslan's identity and scorning the work of his self-sacrifice by standing in place and receiving the punishment that Edmund was due in order to free Edmund, she speaks to Aslan just before he gives his life and tries to send him down into despair. She tries to expose the meaninglessness of his self-sacrifice in giving himself for Edmund. And she says this, and now who has won? Fool, she says to Aslan, do you think that by all of this you would save the human traitor? Now I will kill you instead of him, as our pact was, and so the deep magic will be appeased. But when you are dead, what will prevent me from killing him as well? And who will take him out of my hand then? Understand then that you have given me Narnia forever. You have lost your own life and you have not saved his. In that knowledge, she says, despair and die. But she's wrong. How do we know? Because the crown of glory and honor comes, verse 9, because of the suffering and death. And how does that help those who have him as their champion? Right? Because he tastes death for everyone. Right? His kingship, his championing are made perfect through suffering, as we read in verse 10. And through death, he destroys the one who has the power of death and delivers all those who, through fear of death, were subject to lifelong slavery. After being killed by the White Witch, Aslan explains to Susan and Lucy what his resurrection means. Right? How it is that he could be raised to life. It means, says Aslan, though the witch knew the deep magic, there is a magic deeper still that she did not know. Her knowledge only goes back to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there is a different incantation. That's a different incantation. You think about that word, incantation. We just think of it mostly as, say, a witch casting a spell. But incantation is a song, a chant, right? Cantar, it's a song. And it's to speak a song into something, right? This incantation is the God spell. It's the God song. There was a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would be cracked and death itself would start working backwards. She did not know that. That when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table, the stone table on which he was sacrificed, the death table, would be cracked and death itself would start working backward. Brothers and sisters, our king and our champion is just of that sort. And because of his victory, death is working backward. But we are moving forward into eternal life. So in Jesus, right, we have a king, we have a champion. Thirdly, he's our brother. Right? And what's more is he's not ashamed to call us brothers. Being in a family is humbling. When you live with others, they get to see you more closely than anybody else. They get to see how you deal with stress. They know your weaknesses. They know your pettiness. They know your short temper. They hear what you mumble under your breath, right? They know your self-centeredness. And you can't get away from it. You don't choose your family. You're stuck with your brothers and your sisters. But Jesus is the brother who chose us. And what's more, he's the truest of elder brothers. He didn't stay behind biding his time until he could get the inheritance all for himself. Instead, he shared in our flesh and blood. He partook of the same things as us. He went to a foreign country to find us, to dress our wounds, to pay off our debts, and to bring us back into the Father's loving home. Right? We have just that sort of brother in Jesus Christ. And lastly, he's our high priest. He's Moses and Aaron wrapped up all into one. He came to deliver those who in subjection lived in subjection to lifelong slavery through their fear of death. He came not for angels, but for the offspring of Abraham. He is not a high priest who is so far removed from us that he does not know how to intercede for us. But he is drawn near to us. He for whom and by whom all things exist was in some measure made for us. And to what purpose? Not merely to be like us, but to be of a real help to us. Right? To offer mercy to us, to faithfully serve God, to make sacrifice that turns away the wrath of God because of our sins and bring us into everlasting life with him. Right? To give us peace. We have a priest who himself suffered, who himself knows what it is like to not yet see everything in subjection. who was himself tested in the wilderness between two worlds. You and I have just that kind of high priest who, having offered up himself as a perfect sacrifice, is all but also able to help those of us who are being tempted. Friends, you are living in a wilderness. It's a wilderness of trial and testing. How are you going to make it through? Right? Are you going to do it by merely relying upon yourself? Will you do it by making up your own stories to empower you? Will you do it by not trusting in anything? If you do, you can't. You won't make it through. All who have tried have failed. All who try to do it themselves will fail. So how do you do it? How do you make it through the world of the not yet into the world to come? You do so by faith. Not by being optimistic, not by positivity. You do it by faith, trusting in the one who by his resurrection and ascension has all things under his feet. You do it by putting your faith in the champion who stood in place for you and achieved victory on your behalf. You do it by drawing near the brother who came to find you and bring you home. You do it by trusting in what your high priest has sacrificed for you and sacrificing himself. He's the answer to every accusation. Right? You do it by believing in him. Now, just let me remind you that this work of believing in him and of our own personal transformation, what is the means by which God has chosen to, or a means, a significant means, by which God has chosen to bring about that being made perfect? It's through suffering. It's through this trial of wilderness and temptation, right? But he has got it. He won't waste it. In him, we have peace, and we can have that peace right now, today.